Oh, thank you very much for coming. If you want to come a bit closer, you guys in the back, you might find it a bit easier to hear because my voice isn't the loudest, and sometimes people find they need to tune in to the way I'm speaking. Yeah, Yeshabodhi said, mentioned Pabamati's talk, which I was also very, very moved by, very struck. And he spoke, and I'm going to refer to his talk throughout. My talk is partly in response to his, because in some ways I think we've got a similar story, although it's worked out very differently. And he spoke last week about his fall. He was a bit like David Bowie, you know, sort of falling, the man who fell to earth. His fall from the kind of golden mountain of his ordination retreat. Back in 1998 this was, his fall from this high point, this high peak of his ordination, right down into a very different realm. It's a realm in which for a while at least, everything he'd learned about the spiritual path was utterly irrelevant, you know, to his experience. And instead of living the life he might have expected to live, maybe an order member, you know, teaching and working in the city, his life over these last 16 years has been one of really intense creative activity, you know, promoting the arts in London and developing his own work as a musician with his band. And we've hardly seen him at all here at the centre. I've hardly seen him in all those years. And a highlight from his story was meeting me in Pret-a-Manger in Hammersmith, King Street, High Street, soon after he got back from his ordination retreat. And his girlfriend had left him, and his world was falling apart, and it continued to fall apart over those weeks. And I said to him, well, this feels bad, but it's a great opportunity to develop insight. That's what I said to him. It was my best shot. But it seems that this was not a useful thing to say. I can well believe it. Because it meant nothing to him. You know, when you're in the shit, you know, formulaic ideas, abstract ideas, can sometimes mean nothing. And the Dharma can become just words. I wasn't able to help, and I knew it, really. I might have been someone he looked up to, but even so, I just didn't have the experience to explain how to connect this horribleness to the Dharma he had learned. I just wasn't up to that. And I needed to have my own adventure. And that's partly what I want to share tonight. Because what happened next is an important part of the reason that I'm here. I'm, you know, in the city. So we're still in 1998, and in that year I was still living at Majjhimaloka. Majjhimaloka was a bit of an early prototype of what we now have at Adishtana. It was a kind of a central community where Sangharakshita lived. And I'd been a founder member of that, and I'd been there for quite a few years. And I was not comfortable. I was not comfortable being some kind of a pillar of the establishment because I knew my practice was incomplete. I knew it was very incomplete. And even though I'd lived for years at Vajraloka, I'd meditated deeply, I'd written a well-received book, all that, I still knew I had a long way to go. And so, cutting a long story short, I decided at that point, around that time, to become homeless. I left my privileged life and I became something of a Dharma bum. I began questioning my understanding of Sangharakshita. I began exploring Mahamudra with a teacher called Shenpen Hukam. And I was preparing to leave everything behind for this long retreat that I did a year or so after that time. I was very dissatisfied with my lack of wisdom and my associations with the institutions of the movement had become stale. This can happen. More deeply, I was finding connections with the insight teachings and connections with the elemental basis of our existence in this life. And I was finding connections with the land on which we're born. I was getting connections with nature itself. I was looking for that, and I'm very grateful, and I feel that now. From the bones, if you like, I feel that gratitude for the help I received from what I can only describe as the elements. The elemental powers of nature, you could say. And I don't mean that in an abstract, external sense. I really mean it. It's a connection with something we all share, that came from that opportunity that I was lucky enough to have. It's something that's animated my life ever since, and I want very deeply to continue with that inspiration. So this was something that was around at that time, in the years before and after I met Padmavati at Pret. So at that time I went to India, I went to Bodhgaya, where the Buddha had lived, and then I came back and I did that long solitary. I've talked already here about that. I'm not going to go into that now. And after my retreat, I tried to get other people to come and live with me. But it didn't work. And then I tried to get others to start more of a Tri Ratna style of community on the land. But that didn't work either. And by then I'd met Yashobodhi, and we lived in a caravan not far from Dartmoor. And then both of us joined Guhyapati's eco-activist community in Spain. It's called Eco Dharma. Unfortunately, that didn't work either. The whole project of my getting involved in some kind of collective version of my solitary retreat seems to have been doomed. A doomed project. And in hindsight, I think now there was something a bit quixotic about that. Something a bit of an idea, I think. Anyway, at Eco Dharma, the ideology was just too intense somehow. And that was one reason it didn't work. I'm not going to go into that. But another thing was that neither I nor Yashobodhi felt we had a place there, a real place there. But above all, for me, the heart had gone out of the whole thing. Because I realized that in any case, I could not connect to the land in Spain. And this inability to connect with the elements of nature in Spain, I found it almost heartbreaking. It was something to do with the Spanish landscape. It's so arid and harsh. You know, all the plants there, even the very pretty flowers, they're all so hard and tough. You know, you handle them, you might even cut yourself, you know. There's so little water in the land, it's so hard for the poor little plants to push through the soil. It's like rock. And the prevailing colour is this orangey brown colour. And any greens that you find, I'm not putting it down, I'm just describing it, yeah? Any greens you find are muted, they're bluish or olive. And the plants and trees are small. And the skies are huge, bright and blue. And the sun is intense. It's like this, like all the time, right? And I remember coming back to lead the Total Immersion Retreat in England in June 2010. And the prevailing colour was green. The elm trees and the oak trees were huge. They were tall and they were green. And the grass was bright green. And it was high. It was like high and full of flowers. And what you could see of the sky was grey. It was grey. Sometimes, of course, it was blue because it was summer, right? Early summer. But generally, there was much more grey. And then I appreciated what, to me, to my condition, my English conditioning, what the grey does to the sense of the colour in an English landscape. It was amazing to be in a green field after nearly 3 years on a hill in this vast Spanish landscape. We were in an amazing place out there. We were in an amazing place in this part of Spain. You know, vast landscape. But coming back to this little field in England, this humble little field, well, nice little field, I felt I had come home. I immediately felt connected with the land, to the water, and to the earth. And I was upset that the community in Spain hadn't worked. I found it very upsetting, because at the time I saw it as, you know, the culmination of my life's work. You know, I had that sort of feeling about it. Maybe a rather pretentious feeling, you know, I see that in hindsight. But then I felt this was supposed to be it, and it isn't. But now I think, again, it's a quixotic enterprise, you know, tilting at windmills. My life has definitely found its place here in the city, in London. London is actually where I came from. It's where I started the centre, West London Centre, in the 70s. It's where my grandparents were. It's where my mother grew up. So I feel like I belong here. There were quite a few good practical reasons why Yashobodi and I should move to London after Ikedama. Some good practical reasons, but I think that actually the motivation that drew me here is a lot more irrational. Far harder to explain. And anyway, so far, my move back to London hasn't worked. It's a failure so far. It seemed, you know, coming back to London has seemed like a coming home. But I felt anxious when I came that I might lose this precious connection to the elements and the land, you know, and I would just become an archetypal city person. And in some ways, that is exactly what has happened. That's exactly what has happened, you know. The connection has faded. And my experience has become a lot more complex. A lot more convenient. My life has become a lot more convenient, a lot more safe. And I have an iPhone. And my life somehow seems to have lost some of its significance. I don't believe it really has, but that's how it can feel. And I've forgotten what phase of the moon that we're in. Because I hardly ever see the blooming thing. And the passing of the seasons, has become indicated not by these daily subtle changes in the plant life, and the animals around me, but the changes are indicated by the heat or the cold. Or the change from GMT to British summertime. It means so much less to me. I have a garden. I'm very lucky. I've tried sitting out in my garden. I've tried trips to the heath. I've even tried meditating and reciting rituals on Boadicea's tomb on Hampstead Heath. I broke in and did some rituals there. I've tried doing long walks, and I'm into Padmamati's idea of psychogeography, which he talked about last week. How many people were there, by the way? I need to know this. One, two, maybe just a couple of you. listen to the recording. But this his idea of psychogeography partly seems like a bit of an intellectual trip. I feel, yes, I should go to a different museum every day and soak up the history of London. So many people have lived here. So many people have died here. It's all true. But it all seems so much about information. My father was into London. You know, he was in the LCC after the war. He was the officer responsible for Tower Hamlets. And he had a big hand in the whole South Bank project, in rebuilding that whole area after the war. The room I live in, the room I rent, has loads of books, big, thick books on London. And the walls on my room are covered with these old maps of London. And I've got this picture, this kind of heat map of London. Must be a kind of infrared camera or something of the city with this. It's all black with lots of red bits in it. And you can see the Thames sort of snaking its way through this infrared image of London. But this approach is what is not working for me. It's a bit similar in my mind to the scientific approach to ecology, ecological living, where, you know, these people who know all the current data, you know, they know when exactly we cross the line of peak oil. You know, they know why you should not buy cane syrup, you know, goods with cane syrup, why you should never buy Lego, you know, or what have you. It's too much about the information. I find too much reliance on information to be spiritually depressing. So I want to find a new way to bring a more elemental perspective to my life in London. And so far I've partially failed to do this. But Pamamati's talk, which a few of you heard, most of you do not hear, it really gave me some hope. So after all his ordination, Pamamati fell from the Golden Mountain down to a pit full of his own shit, metaphorically speaking. But eventually he managed to not only to climb out of that pit, but somehow to create his own totally sustainable Golden Mountain out of it. My long retreat was also, as you might imagine, a long fall into reality. As though after the high Golden Mountain of Majjhimaloka, I also fell. I fell to earth, and I too fell metaphorically into a pit filled with the waste products of my own imagination. You know, it's a pure coincidence that I actually did fall literally into my shit pit at one point. That only underlines the truth of that metaphor. I feel that my connection with the elemental life of this city, when I finally make it happen, is going to be different. It's not going to be this will self style psychogeography. It's not going to be about history or information, historical information. But what it will be about, I don't know. I'm currently failing, and I wish I could talk about it more with more people, actually. I wish our centre could somehow explore these things. Because I feel that the Dharma in the city has to interact with the locality. And our locality is amazing. It's an amazing locality. I wish generally that contemporary urban Dharma with its secular culture of the arts could also connect with those pagan, elemental, pre-Roman roots that includes something like psychogeography. But they use the Dharma to transcend all that clever literary congeniality that I associate with it. But being asked to give this talk has stirred something up for me. It's about Dharma in the city, and cities have been around for a very, very long time. I mean, I looked it up, and it's been since King Gilgamesh ruled Uruk in the 27th century BC. It's been going that long. And Uruk is now buried deep under the sands of Iraq. And it's the earliest city we know about. So cities have evolved since over those 48 centuries to suit our human needs and wants. There are an expression of our human needs and wants, which is an amazing thing. And yet, despite all that increased convenience and safety, cities still seem full of suffering. Indeed, the city is often portrayed as some kind of a hell realm. But actually, after 30 years away, on moving back to London, my experience of the city is far from a hell realm. It's far from a hell realm. The city to me seems like a kind of a deva realm. A wonderful place where you can just be with thousands of other people. Completely anonymously if you want, or you can easily talk to them and learn from them. Learn from them just by observing them, all human life is here, as they say. I think London is surely, it's a pleasure ground for anyone who is reflective, any reflective individual who wonders about the nature of human existence has something amazing here. Yet I know that for many of us, there's this big question mark hanging in the air about the value and the significance of city life for the spiritual practitioner. City life is a rich but confusing experience. It's a kind of a crucible, it's a kind of pot, or maybe it's a skull cup of human life wherein cultures and often individuals too get melted down and they get fashioned into something new and strange. And so maybe I should ask you, what is city life doing to you? I think Buddhists tend to resist city life. The Buddhists I know often seem to resist city life. But whether they do that or not, human beings generally are doing it more and more. I mean, living in cities. The population of cities, again, I looked it up. The population is huge already, but it's set to almost double over the next 40 years. Around the Bronze Age, when cities started, okay, we're getting into the information now, there's only a tiny proportion, maybe 1% of humanity lived within the safety of city walls. So Uruk represented a very small slice of the human cake. But it all started changing over the last couple of millennia. And since the Middle Ages, more and more and more and more of us have made that big move from the country to the city. It always goes that way. That's the draw, if you like. By 1900, 13% of humanity had made that transition. And half a century later, when I was born in 1949, it was about 30%. Mushroom to 30%. And over my lifetime, the population of cities has increased to 50% of humanity. When I get to my 100th birthday, the figure will have almost doubled from that. So it'll be 75% of the world's population is going to be in cities. So though we might all struggle to practice the Dharma in the city, that is where we are, and that is where we're going to be, on the whole. So, I think we can't afford to not face this. It's a key. It's a key to our practice, and I think the main key, I think, to all this is that we are a community. We're a community of practitioners, individual practitioners, but we all share the refugees we chanted this evening. We all share the ethical precepts, and we share the spiritual vision of the path, the tradition of Shakyamuni Buddha, who also had a relationship with the city, actually. He was into the city, even though he lived in the country. In our community, we want to share that, so we interact to make the Dharma available to others here in London. We're all practicing. We're all practicing to bring these ideals alive in our own lives. We're all working on our ethics best we can. You know, our meditation and our wisdom. And the way we help one another is by meeting. Meeting is a major spiritual practice. We're doing it now. Meeting is what keeps the community alive. Because in meetings we connect our individual understanding to that of others. One way or another. It might not be very explicitly worked out, but that's what we do. We compare and contrast. And this is one of the great things about the city. You can certainly meet, you know, everyone is more easily available. I'm stressing the positive things about the city. I know people tend to struggle with practice, because there is just so much going on in the city. It can seem like there's just too much to do. I know this. And when that feeling takes hold of us, practice in the city can start to become a kind of a problem. You can start getting into this mindset whereby you view yourself as living in very, very unideal conditions. You think, if only I lived in the country. And our Dharma life becomes a matter of keeping up the practice against the odds, and you just keep it up until you can, you know, get away on retreat at last. And actually, retreats are very important. Retreats give us an opportunity for those important, weighty, spiritual moments. The deep meditations and the deep reflections that we never forget and which influence us very profoundly. Those happen on retreat very often. But that's only half of the story. That's like the Golden Mountain part of the story, you know. Because most of our life we spend immersed in habit. We have to come down from that mountain. Dharma practice has to come home. It needs to come down to where we are at our worst very often. And in a particular sense, that's our real Dharma practice. All that habitual activity that we're laying down all the time in our normal lives. I think we need to revise the attitude that we can't practice if we're distracted or if we're confused or if we're having some kind of a meltdown. And that means understanding what it feels like when we do try and practice in those circumstances, recognizing that. And of course it doesn't feel like when you're on retreat because, as we've noted, at such times the Dharma can seem completely meaningless. But still, it's working. The practice is still working. Even if it looks and feels different. When we're challenged, Dharma practice is even more worth doing, actually. And every tiny success is worth celebrating. And the success can be tiny, but in those circumstances, it's incredibly important. Because it's the outcome that's important. It's the outcome in terms of our life overall that's important. It's not the immediate feeling, the immediate temporary experience. It's the actual change, the actual outcome. The problem I think we associate with city life is all that potential distraction. There's a lot of great things to do here. There's people to see. There's places to go. But why does that have to be a problem? Surely that's why we're here. That's why we came here. That's what city life is all about. It's simply lots more convenient, lots more creative to be living around other people. I know what it's like to live in the country. You have to drive everywhere, and there's a few people you can visit immediately. It's much more creative to live around other people. Even if still you have to get on the tube, etc. At the same time, there's an availability that we have here that we don't have in the country. And the problematic side, you know, it's true that having so much useful stuff around us can distract us and confuse us. So, okay, what about not being confused? Even, what about learning? What about training ourselves to use the city to our spiritual advantage? I think this can certainly be difficult. In fact, maybe that's what we should be teaching here. I mean, you know, there's an idea. But before we get to that, fundamental to that retraining of ourselves, perhaps, maybe we could do some reflecting on what we have here in the city so that we fully appreciate it. Once upon a time, all human beings lived in indigenous tribal circumstances, in some kind of Eden, if you like, in caves or in the forest, embedded in the community they were born into. And I think we think of that as being very, very peaceful and clear and calm. You know, there's a tiny number of people who still do that in this world. And in that world, any man or woman who are born with a brilliant mind, someone who in our world would be recognized as a genius of some kind, they'd be likely to live out their entire life without ever being able to communicate fully to anyone else, ever. Without being able to develop their thinking or their understanding, or at most, they could develop it as far as their tradition, their collective history of experience, would make possible. Traditions vary. Some would make it more possible, some would make it practically impossible. Probably they would not have the language or the cultural forms needed for that expression. Nowadays, in our culture, our communications in particular have evolved to the point where there is amazing creativity going on. It's completely unprecedented. We learn so much from one another these days. We help one another in amazing ways in our culture. Technology has played a major part in this, but it's the organization and localization of cities in particular that have allowed us to meet and to exchange ideas on the huge scale that we do. This is something amazing, and we can run it down. We can think it's too much. This principle of, we could call it, finds its expression also in the internet, which again makes unlimited amounts of information available to all those with the imagination to really use it. It's just a huge cliche to say we're all connected. But that connection carries with it such potential for change, such education connection, that I feel we need actively to appreciate the value. I feel I need to say it. And I say, let's not do the easy thing and write it off as unhelpful for our Dharma lives. Just because it can also become part, a big part, of the distraction of our lives. I want to honour it. So, let's just not be distracted amidst all this. Let's just learn not to. Let's just make the effort not to be confused, because we have the tools to do that. Distraction is actually something we allow to happen. If we do not guard our senses, there's always going to be too much information. If we lose our sense of purpose, we're always going to be overwhelmed by the data that's coming in, sense data that's coming in. This is the modern challenge, all right? We need to appreciate our amazing good fortune, and from that perspective, we need to use it for the spiritual growth and health of all beings. That's all beings in the city. And also all the other beings worldwide that we're affecting by our actions. You know, I mean the beings in the oceans and the forests who we share this planet with, who are not able to express to us what our actions are doing to them. I spent a lot of time living simply, as you know. When I was living in the woods, I was happy simply observing the changing seasons. Which from this perspective sounds boring, from that perspective was really engaging. The changes involved with that are incredibly diverse and meaningful when you're in that space. But the thing is, I want to say, you know, reducing input doesn't reduce experience. In a way, it doesn't actually reduce anything. It's more that your senses notice more detail within that reduced range of information. You discover that less reveals more. The more time you spend with a tree, or anything at all, the more there is to see about it. So in fact, the volume of information actually doesn't get any less. But it does get simpler and clearer to relate to, you could say. It's an important point I'm making. When looking into the nature of city living, because living more simply doesn't necessarily mean that you don't get distracted. That can still happen. Even if you're living in a cave, you're still confronted with the same decisions about how you're going to use your mind. Just like we do in the city. And that problem is basically the same. It's not really an excuse, this idea that our lives are too complex. There's nothing special about our circumstances, really. Indigenous peoples, for example, the Tibetans before our current age, or the tribal societies in the Amazon or New Guinea, who still live almost entirely in nature. Yes, they live simple lives, but they can also be very complicated people. Simplicity just means you see more in less. And so people's minds just get occupied by things we wouldn't notice. For example, indigenous peoples often see spirits, invisible beings, whose needs entail all kinds of implications for human interaction that we would just not be able to anticipate, but which can make life quite involved and quite time-consuming in those societies. So in general, indigenous peoples tend to get obsessed by just the same volume and just the same kind of thoughts. The content is a bit different, but the mind states are similar. So the idea of primitive life being simple is a romantic myth. There can be as much obsessiveness going on in a hut in New Guinea as when you have eBay, Twitter, and Facebook all open at the same time. Anyway, there's a point I'm making here. It's like we can compare our lives to living in the forest, where life is simple but rich. We can compare our lives to the forest where life is simple but rich, to the city where life is rich but is often not simple. And I wonder if we are just missing the simplicity and whether we cannot somehow reconnect with a basic simplicity in the city. I don't think there's anything preventing us doing that. really. Maybe some of you have done some bushcraft. Going into the woods and just looking and seeing. A good guide to bushcraft who really knows how to look at the forest. They see far, far more detail and far more significance than we do with our untrained attention. We don't notice anything like as much in the woods or in the city. We don't see the subtle signs, the quality of the bird song, the individual cries, the muffled snap of a twig, a rustle over there, a slight change in the temperature or in the air pressure. Maybe we could relax into our environment a bit more here. Maybe we could see more here, hear more here, understand more about where we actually are. Our attitude tends to be one of getting here rather than giving or simply listening and looking. If we tend to see our living environment as a set of circumstances for getting what we want, we're going to be narrowed by that attitude. In the same way that if we just see our own body, another complex environment, if we just see our body as a machine for getting from A to B, or for getting stuff done, again, that's going to narrow our experience of our body. It doesn't relax us, it doesn't make us wise. We don't learn anything if we don't respect our body and our environment, whatever that is. The body is a kind of a teacher. The city too, I think, could be a teacher. It is like the forest. It's a rich environment filled with messages from beyond us. But to hear the message, I think we need to learn to be more simple, more aware, more present, more expectant. That's what I think. And it's, for me, it's an exploration. I don't know where to go with it. So maybe you have some thoughts, questions, things that you'd like to say in the time that we've got.